From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
You're listening to Money Talk for March 29th, 2024. Good Friday. The Bucks have a few home games this week. The Grizzlies on Wednesday and the Raptors on Friday. Baseball fans head to Brewers home opener against the Twins on Tuesday at AmFam Field. That just doesn't sound right, does it? Marketing. It's all about marketing. The latest brilliant campaign to separate you from your money is water in a can. This groundbreaking product is called Liquid Death, and it doesn't come from a sparkling spring, an underground cave, or even a Canadian waterfall. Where does it come from, you're probably asking yourself right now? Well, it comes from the tap. Yep, plain old tap water. But they've got a $1.5 billion valuation and millions of social media followers, so obviously they're doing something right. For something a little more flavorful, check out the new Belgium Brewery of Colorado, which is brewing up Tombstone-flavored beer. The brewery tasting notes include crispy crust, tangy tomato sauce, and a dash of pepperoni. No mention of pineapple, though. A police station in New Orleans has a rat problem. The rats are getting into the evidence room and eating all of the marijuana. They're all high, says the police superintendent of the furry little fugitives. At least they should be easier to catch. Maybe you just need a bag of chips or some of that pizza-flavored beer. Finally, in a rather ironic twist, the world's oldest known lipstick was recently found in Iran. And if you're wondering where the irony comes in, Iran prohibits the use of makeup. On today's show, I've got Dave Sandstrom, Tom Pappenfuss, Joel Driesing, and with the week in review, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Jason. Okay, week overall, a bit mixed results. The NASDAQ actually down 0.3%, losing 49 points on the week to close at 16,379. The S&P, however, up 0.4%, up 20 points, closing at 52,54. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 331 points on the week after adding 47 points Thursday, the last trading day of the Easter-shortened week, to finish the week up 0.8% at 39,807 for the year. The NASDAQ now up 9.3%, including dividends. The S&P 500 up 10.5%, including dividends. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 6.1% through the first quarter. A pretty strong quarter overall, Dave. Plenty to be excited about, I think, as we look at putting a quarter in the books with meaningful gains on stocks more broadly. And so certainly, I think, as we look at where we've come so far, plenty to be happy about there.
Yeah, Kyle, the momentum continues. We had coming on the heels of a very strong market recovery in 23. 24 continues along those same lines. And I think a lot of it's bolstered by just really solid economic numbers. You know, we're looking at GDP numbers that were upgraded for the end of the last year. Saw those numbers this morning and actually upgraded to the upside, meaning we actually had more economic growth than was originally anticipated. And they even tweaked a couple of the inflation numbers down a little bit as well. So you couple that with a 2.5-year high on a consumer sentiment poll that came out as well. It all kind of points to the fact that the investors are feeling pretty good about the U.S. economy and business in general, and the momentum has been very strong.
You know, Joel, that final revision for GDP, clearly a very strong number for fourth quarter. We're seeing kind of GDP now estimates from the Fed pointing to maybe 2.1% economic growth in the first quarter. And signs seem to be indicating that consumers are pretty eager to spend.
Hey, Kyle, remember since 2022, 2 years ago now, the Fed was raising interest rates to try to slow down the economy. And we were all worried about recessions. And that hasn't come yet, knock wood. Will come eventually, but here we are. As you and Dave pointed out, we're just seeing it's getting stronger. The thing that helped the upward revision of the GDP for the fourth quarter was consumers were spending stronger than were estimated. They had three estimates for the GDP. The first one, they said that on an annual basis, spending was going up by 2.8%. Then they said, no, it was 3%. And now they're saying it was 3.3%. So that's a pretty healthy pace and encouraging that it was picking up. And then, as Dave said, the inflation number, which is, remember, what the Fed has been trying to do by raising interest rates, is tamp down inflation number. And on a year-to-year basis, in the fourth quarter, it was up 2.8%. And that's the lowest it's been since March of 2021. So making progress on tamping down inflation, but also the economy's strong.
And at the same time, we seem to be getting so much noise in the consumer confidence surveys. You know, it's one of those where, by all accounts, we should be pretty ecstatic with the shape of the economy. As consumers, generally, we're making more, our portfolios are worth more, our houses are worth more. And so those tend to be things that feed into a happy consumer. And when you ask them how they feel, they should feel pretty good, I would think, and yet, you know, still mixed results when we look at those confidence surveys.
Yeah, you know, it's the difference between asking somebody how they feel and then watching to see what they do, because the consumers are still spending, but they're saying that they're nervous. They're saying, and it was interesting because we had, as Dave pointed out, the consumer sentiment numbers, which are, you know, some of the best numbers that we've seen in a couple of years now. But we also had the consumer confidence numbers from the conference board. And those were actually, I found kind of amusing, because half of the consumers are saying that they expect interest rates to go up this year. And, you know, we're all talking about, you know, we're waiting for the Fed to start lowering rates. The consumers were saying in this conference board report that they were concerned about inflation, and yet at the same time, their expectations for inflation were the lowest in 4 years. So a bit of mixed news there. And again, there's pessimism there that's being expressed, but more so than you would see from what the spending has been.
And I touched on the housing data, but we got some reports this week on housing as well.
That's right. Yeah, we had some numbers today from the National Association of Realtors about their pending home sales, and that was up. And they're expecting a steady rise in inventory. We talked about that a little last week, where there are more new houses that are being built, and those are available. And so there's a feeling that there's a pent-up demand by a lot of people who have been wanting to move since 2020. And then, you know, the housing market went all haywire with COVID and lockdowns and people moving from cities to suburbs and all that stuff. And maybe they're going to be finding some of that inventory of new houses to move into, and that's going to free up their existing house for somebody else who wants to buy. So there may be more of a catching up between supply and demand that could help tamp down the price increases on housing, but we're still seeing those go up, because we had a report this week from the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller price index, and it went up. It accelerated, actually, the seventh month in a row. They had a year-to-year increase in housing prices of 6%.
And then, Dave, the courts came in and maybe dropped a bit of a bomb to the real estate market in terms of some of the money that might have to be paid back to recent home buyers from their agents, and drastically potentially shaping what those commissions look like going down the road. No longer able to charge that captive fee, but potentially allowing consumers to negotiate now. And that has the potential, I think, to impact what the housing market looks like, and in particular, the selling market for houses looks like going forward.
You know, it's interesting, Kyle, that there's a lot of mixed opinions on the results of what's going to happen with that now. What it appears to look like maybe a win for sellers and reducing the commissions they pay when you sell your house. Some economists now pointed to the fact that it may pose a problem for the buyer, because most buying, you know, the agents that represent a buyer don't typically like to work for free. And now if they're going to get paid a commission, it's going to have to come from the buyer. And as we see, most Americans struggle to put together a reasonable down payment to begin with. If they have to come up with a couple of percent to pay the buyer commission, that could even squeeze the buyers a little bit more. So jury's out on this one a little bit. On one side, could help sellers pocket a couple extra bucks, but it also could put a little extra pressure on the buyers. So we'll have to see how this thing settles in.
Yeah, and I think especially when you're talking about those buyers looking for first-time homes, those buyers looking for maybe some lower dollar value homes, I wouldn't be too terribly excited as an agent to show them 50 houses and get, you know, maybe a $500 check for my work, as opposed to that nice selling commission that I used to get as a percentage of the sale price. And so I think you are shifting incentives a little bit there. But also there's technological solutions there. There's other ways that I think the market will adapt. And so, to your point, jury's still out. But, I think this is certainly one more thing in terms of how things are changing from a technology perspective, from a regulatory perspective that, we'll bear watching, especially as it relates to the housing market.
And to the degree that those fees are going to motivate more sellers maybe to move out of their homes, that's going to help the whole supply situation.
Yeah, potentially if you're capturing more of that sale price, that's one more reason why you might be willing to move a little quicker. So, Tom, maybe a good time to bring you in. We pointed to at the open, the NASDAQ up 9.3%. We've seen such a strong run in technology stocks and, growth stocks more broadly. And yet, as we start to look at prices, it seems like maybe that area of the market's getting a little expensive.
Yeah, I think it's important to note at this point in time when we've had such a strong start to the year. I think one of the, 14th strongest quarter to start a year in the last, 60, 70 years. The natural question, especially maybe you two are experiencing this when you talk to people, is, well, maybe they're hesitant to invest more money or they're worried about a pullback here. It just seems like we're due to valuations, just based on the run we have. I think there's a couple of points that I kind of point to that, I think that could happen perhaps at some point, but there's also plenty of strong cases why it may not and why you don't want to be out of the markets. And one of the most important things for the overall health of the market is market breadth is widening. 80% of the S&P 500 companies are now trading above their 200-day moving average. 25% of the companies have now hit new all-time highs. So it's just really important to note that is a good indicator of overall market health, that more companies are starting to participate. I think smart investors, Wall Street money is looking for better values out there. And so you're starting to see other companies now participate in these gains. The other kind of thing I kind of mentioned is that, and this is just based on historical or statistical averages, is that usually when you hit highs, you tend to hit more highs, historically speaking, that the momentum hasn't quite run its course yet, perhaps. And I think, on average, when you have a start to the year like we have, over the next 12 months, the average return is another 12%. And on average, we're up 75% of the time over the next 12 months. Again, this is no past performance is no indicator of future returns, as we have to always say. But it does, case precedent says that, well, as Joel mentioned with economic data, things are good. I mean, there's some good, strong fundamental fabric here to support things. And so I'm not discouraged. I'm cautious, but I'm not discouraged at all.
Tom, I like your comments about the market breadth widening a little bit. It gets real, enticing and maybe a little bit concerning to chase just a handful of names like I think a lot of investors have done in the past 18 months. And they've been rewarded for that because of what's happened with what has recently been known as the Magnificent Seven. But if you take that group alone, those price earnings ratios, those P's are starting to get to some areas that we haven't seen very often in the last 30 years. So it's encouraging to see some of the other areas of the market starting to come forward. And I like the fact that, especially in the value side of the market, the environment for banks, especially with we're finally at the top, potentially, I guess, at the top of the rate cycle now, that's going to be a little bit more encouraging for those financial institutions who took a big hit on their balance sheets when rates went through the roof. They had to discount a lot of their assets. Now that is starting to even out and then slowly come down, that's going to give them a little break there. And it's also going to help banks increase their margins with rates being elevated after living in a 0% interest rate world for so long. So that gives another area of the market that potentially has that ability to continue to widen that breadth.
Well, even factoring in, as you mentioned, with multiples, PE multiples, and looking at that narrow area of companies that are priced at 28 times earnings or whatever it may be, when you look at their expected earnings growth over the next 12 months to 24 months, it's about 12% a year compared to the rest of the other 493 companies, which is about 4. So you're paying a premium to get that extra dollar of earnings. So it's not unjustified. So I guess another reason why It's expensive. Yes, you can certainly make that argument, but it is, you know, justified, I guess, in the end.
And I think, you know, this speaks to something, Joel, that I have put in the newsletter set to come out tomorrow. A good reminder, if you aren't subscribed, you head over to our website or reach out to us to get subscribed. But that, you know, Tom's point, which I think I echo in the newsletter, is that all of this is taking place at a time in which the economy is still quite strong, right? This is not an economy that's turning quickly toward cold here. It's an economy that's still running warm, if not hot. And so as, you know, we kind of approach, you know, the seasonality of, you know, the weather, and we're into spring now with opening day today for baseball and with kind of March Madness wrapping up and all the kind of typical things that come along with spring, you know, the market seems to be in a very different place. And so I point that out in the newsletter, and then we've got some other good stuff in the newsletter as well.
Yeah, Kyle, I liked your piece because you were basically saying what Tom and Dave were just saying, is that you shouldn't be discouraged by success. That, you know, especially for long-term investors, it pays off to hang in there, and you actually have a reference to a study that shows that. And we have a piece in there that Jason actually suggested that we alert people to the fact that there are a lot of data breaches. And, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do about data breaches, but there are steps that you can take to sort of minimize the downfall if you've been exposed to a data breach. And I think I saw somewhere that one out of four of us have been exposed to a data breach at some point or another, and that usually ends up in identity theft and can be very costly. And then we have something in there about the we every month have a Money Talk quiz looking at the podcast and teasing out little highlights from the past month or so of podcasts, and it's a multiple choice quiz, and people can look at that and test their knowledge.
And then I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the passing of Daniel Kahneman this week, behavioral economist, passed at the age of 90. And really a lot of research from him and some of his colleagues on the nature of regret and investors being regret prone. Kahneman points out in one of his studies that investors are 2.25 times more averse to loss than they are to the potential gain on the other side. And just, I think, echoing what we know from talking to clients, what we know from talking to investors, that, you know, the potential for loss is a very meaningful motivator. And it can cause clients to make some bad choices at times. And so I think a key to what we do in preaching balance, a key to what we do in kind of talking to investors about ensuring that you're not missing out, but also that you're not taking more risk than you're comfortable with, so that we can ensure that, you know, you're not going to be prone to regret, that you're not going to make a bad decision simply because stocks look a little expensive now. Well, yeah, remember that they can get a lot more expensive, and they can stay irrational a lot longer than you can stay solvent. And so I think the key is avoid the need to react. And I think what Kahneman really spent much of his life discussing was, you know, how investors in particular, not always directly, but how investors in particular can construct something in a way that helps them avoid that regret.
And his Nobel Prize was in economics, right? But he was a psychologist.
Yeah, always, as you and I were talking before the program, always interesting how those things overlap, right? That we think of economics as maybe a firmer, a harder science than some of the social sciences like psychology. And yet, you know, I think when you look at decision-making amongst consumers, a big focus of his study, it required certainly the psychology and sociology understanding that he had, but it ultimately impacts the economic picture. And so neat to see, you know, one of the founders of behavioral economics, or at least listed as one of the founders of behavioral economics, so neat to see how his life's work kind of applies to so much of what we do. And I think worth pointing out that, you know, his passing this week will be another, I think, tough thing for the economists out there to bear. So, and again, so grateful to have you as a listener. We enjoy doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.